Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're
yeah, we did.
Solartopia, Solartopia.
We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, our Solartopia theme song. Been with us for a while. Boy, I miss Pete Seeger. David Burns and Dar Williams are still with us. I just listened to Dar Williams' album the other day. She's fantastic. If you never heard Dar Williams' music, you really got to get to it. We have a great show today. Two really terrific guests. One's just going to be with us for a short time, Frank Rebar. Frank, you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, and Steve Strong, are you with us?
I'm here.
All right, wonderful. So, Steve, we're going to devote most of the hour to you as we talk, but I have something came up. I need to give a couple of minutes here to Frank Rebar. Frank, you're calling from Central Ohio, I believe. You have a conference this weekend in Central Ohio about moving to amend the Constitution of the United States to curtail corporate power. And I do want to have you on and your cohorts on for a full show about corporate power and the move to amend. But it came to my attention you're having a conference this weekend. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right, give us the details of that before we get to Steve Strong and the solar energy. But tell us about your conference this weekend, if you would.
Our conference is going to be Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. It'll be at the First Unitarian Universalist Church at 93 West Weisheimer Road.
That's in Columbus, Ohio?
Yes.
And at what time?
It'll be from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m.
And you are going to talk about the constitutional amendment that would overturn the horrendous Citizens United decision granting personal rights to corporations. Is that correct?
Correct. There's been Citizens United is one of many constitutional decisions that have done this, and our amendment is designed to overturn all these bad decisions that were made over a 100-year period, and hopefully restore citizenship. Human rights should only be for natural-born humans, is what we believe, not for corporations, and that's what we're shooting for. Also, another big decision was Buckley versus Vallejo, where they equated money and speech as the same thing, so you can't regulate money. And part of our amendment is that money is not a form of speech. That overturns that. So hopefully we'd be able to control some of the money entering our political system.
Yes. All right. Well, listen, I'm going to have you back on for a full show at some point after your conference. But okay. Your conference is this weekend, Saturday, all day at the Unitarian Church on Weisheimer Road in Columbus, Ohio. What is the email, the website that people can come to?
MoveToAmend.org.
MoveToAmend.org, and I'm sure the conference is listed there. So all you folks listening in the Central Ohio area, and I'm sure there are a few of you, please do come to this conference. Is there a charge, Frank Rebar, for this conference?
There's no charge. It's open to the public. We do ask for a $5 donation to cover some of the costs for the church.
Okay. I'm sure the Koch brothers will be there with their open checkbook.
I'm sure they will.
Keep things going. Thanks so much, Frank Rebar. I'm sorry I got late notice on this. Actually, I did not get late notice, but my email hid your message. So we will have you back on for a full hour to talk about Move to Amend later on the Solartopia show. Okay, so thanks so much, Frank Rebar, for being with us.
Having a good day, Harvey.
You have a great conference, and I will try and make it up there. Actually, I can't make it. I will be in Ann Arbor. Just for your information, folks, Ann Arbor, in Ann Arbor, Michigan, this weekend is a 50th anniversary commemoration of the first Vietnam teach-in at the University of Michigan, which was in March of 1965. And I guess I'm proud to say that I was there as a student I was a sophomore at the University of Michigan in 1965. I very clearly remember the Vietnam teach-ins, and this weekend they are devoting the teach-in not to the war in Vietnam. Thank God it would still be going on if we hadn't had a citizen movement to stop it, but to saving the environment and to global warming. And I will be doing a panel Saturday afternoon on the joy of eco-activism. A lot of other activists there. Actually, there are going to be two professors there, or three, who actually spoke at the teach-in 50 years ago. So that's very impressive. They're going to be speaking on issues of globalization, war, and I hope also on longevity. Okay, so down to business. Steve Strong, you're still with us?
Yes, sir.
All right, and you were talking to us from Massachusetts, and you are one of the great pioneers in the business of solar energy and the technology and the spread of solartopian technology around the world. And just for a small anecdote, I had seen your picture. I knew who you were for many years. And then I was giving a speech in somewhere in New Hampshire, a beautiful town in New Hampshire, about election theft, a completely not a completely other issue, but a separate issue. And I recognized you in the audience, and was honored to meet you. After the show, I gave you the first edition of Solartopia, the vision of a green-powered Earth that I somehow had back in the mid-2000s, and you called me the next day and corrected something I had. I had the book featuring a hydrogen-powered airplane, and you pointed out to me quite generously and gently that hydrogen airplanes are highly unlikely. And so in the ensuing editions, and your arguments made perfect sense, and in the ensuing editions, I changed the airplanes to a hybrid of solar and biofuels, which I think is reasonable. And in fact, we do have a has that solar airplane finished flying around the world, or are they still in the process? Do you know, Steve Strong?
They've just left Myanmar, and they've got one more stop in Southeast Asia, I believe, and then they're headed across the Pacific to Hawaii, and then to land in the mainland U.S. and continue from there across the Atlantic and ultimately back to Abu Dhabi, which is where they started.
Wow. That's really impressive. And there's, what, two people on this plane, and it's 100% solar, right?
It's 100% solar. There's battery capacity on board. They fly day and night. They go up to about 5 miles altitude during the day to harvest as much sun in the thinner atmosphere with the colder temperatures. And then they gently glide through the night because the wingspan is much larger than even a 747. They've got a glide ratio that's just amazing. And they've got enough power, of course, as well, so they can fly all night and then climb back up during the day. It's a single-seat cockpit. The co-pilot, they switch off six to eight-hour shifts, and there's a very modest berth behind the cockpit where the co-pilot can sleep. It's
wow.
An amazing mission. And it's very similar, Harvey. You probably know about the Planet Solar, the solar catamaran that circled the Earth.
No, let's hear about that.
These are both projects that have some start in Switzerland. Thank you for the Swiss for all that. And this is a very substantial catamaran, ocean-going, that is powered completely by solar cells. And I had the privilege of visiting with the crew and touring the ship when it came into Boston. It was an unexpected port of call as they came up the East Coast. They were monitoring currents in the Gulf Stream and doing some other scientific effort, and then headed across back to the Mediterranean where they were headed. But it's an amazing ship.
What's it called? What's the name of it?
Planet Solar.
That's the name of the ship.
Yes, it's the name of their program.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And both the Solar Impulse and the Planet Solar ship are powered by the highest efficiency monocrystalline solar cells, which are made by a company that's headquartered in Silicon Valley, SunPower.
Wow, that's really, really amazing. So these is it two guys in the airplane?
That's it.
And so one of them sits in the seat, and the other one, I guess there's kind of a long, narrow berth behind where he sleeps?
Correct.
Have you seen this plane?
I've seen a lot of material on it. I have not seen the plane.
Is it going to land on the east coast of the United States?
I expect that they will make an east coast stop. They haven't published where just yet.
Wow. That's mind-boggling. So this will be the first time that an airplane has circumnavigated the Earth. Could they, do they have the physical capacity with this airplane to go all the way around the Earth without landing?
Yes, they could. The airplane could do it, but the pilots couldn't.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
They got to eat.
Oh, that. That's really astounding. And so this is a first. Why Abu Dhabi?
I don't know the answer to that, except maybe there was some funds that might have helped the program along that would help to support that decision.
Well, that would be ironic, wouldn't it? I mean, you would assume Abu Dhabi it would be oil money.
Well, you know, the interesting thing is we get into the program, I'll tell you about the largest project that's ever been LEED Platinum certified was done for the King of Saudi Arabia. And it's the King Abdullah University of Science and Technology, which is the first university to be planned from the ground up to be completely powered by solar. And its entire mission, this is 6 million square feet of world-class academic and research laboratories. The entire purpose of this institution is what King Abdullah called post-petroleum sciences.
Where is this place?
It's on the coast of the Red Sea, about 70 kilometers north of Jeddah.
Have you been there?
I have not. I didn't have to go there, but we designed the solar systems for the
You designed the campus. Solar systems?
Yes.
Okay, so who is you? You have a company. Yeah, what's your company's company called?
Solar Designs.
And you are just outside of Boston, right?
Correct.
Wow. So you designed the whole thing and you never went there?
I didn't need to. We were able to. It was quite a project, actually, for a small group like us. It was like college exam week for about 5 months.
How long a period was devoted to doing this?
I would say five engineers full time for 3 months.
Wow!
And a lot of additional administrative support. You had professionals from a dozen different countries speaking almost as many different languages. You had all of the time zones around the world. You had the principal client language being Arabic. I mean, it was quite a challenge. We had even just to figure out what codes we were designing to, because the equipment came from all around the world, and the stuff that's made in Germany doesn't necessarily work here, and the stuff that's made in the U.S. doesn't work there, and et cetera. It was quite a challenge, but we got it done. The King, when he announced the project, said, we're going to have this done in 3 years, and the dedication date is going to be X. And that was it. When the King says something gets done, it gets done. I was absolutely amazed.
No matter what happened. How did you come to be the contractor on this?
They called us.
Wow. That's mind-boggling to me. What is the capacity of the systems that you designed and are now in place?
Oh goodness, many, many megawatts.
Did you not have a target goal for how many megawatts you had to put in?
Oh yeah, we did. That was I don't even remember now. It's a lot. We have another project in Saudi coming up, actually.
When did this first one go online? When did it open?
4 years ago, probably.
So, have you gotten any calls on the warranty? Are they satisfied? What's the deal?
Well, We didn't produce the hardware, so we're not carrying the warranty on the installation. We just did the design and engineering and specified the hardware. We helped to procure it, but that was all. Basically, just put the buyers and sellers together and said, you really need to use this stuff in order to get the power output that you want.
And what have you heard? Is the customer satisfied?
Yeah, all reports are yes.
Mind-boggling. Did they use LED lighting in this facility?
Yes, but they didn't scrimp. This is a palace compared with most university campuses that you'd see in the U.S., and it's because it's the King's legacy.
How many students go there?
Well, this is just graduate level. And it's a research university, and so people are invited to come, and it's the creme de la creme. They've been picking professors, not really anxious to make a full-time, long-term career commitment, so they give them basically sabbatical appointments for a year or 2 years or something like that, which is the popular way to go, and they're getting them from Stanford, from MIT, from Harvard, all the top schools. And the interesting part about this is that it is all open source. This is something the King wanted to share. He basically said at the dedication that our economy is built on oil. Oil is finite. We need to be looking beyond that, and this is what Kaust's mission is all about. Post-petroleum sciences. So this is new forms of agriculture, aquaponics, hydroponics, soil sciences, material sciences, upcycling, recovery of resources, advanced water purification, all of the things that you're going to want to have when the petroleum runs out is being done at Kaust. It's 6 million square feet of world-class academic and research laboratories, and it was completed in 3 years from first conversation to full occupancy. And that's not just classrooms. That's completely outfitted, state-of-the-art laboratories in every science discipline that's of relevance.
What's the name of this place?
Kaust, King Abdullah University of Science and Technology. So think about it. This is the monarch who is sitting on the highest remaining portion of oil reserves in the world, and this is his legacy to his people. He passed away, by the way, about a month ago.
Right, that's right. Mind-boggling. That is astounding. Haven't they invited you to come speak or teach there? I mean, you would think that they'd want you there to talk about the design and all that stuff.
This is not basic solar electricity. This is advanced material science and physics and physical chemistry. And this is all top-notch PhD level, very, very deep, very intensive. The solar system design, it's an important component, but this is research. It's looking over the horizon. It's not just understanding simply what's available today. They're taking that for granted as the jumping off point.
So we are now to assume that the world's most advanced research into the technology of Solartopia, of a green-powered Earth, is being done in Saudi Arabia, where the oil comes from. That's mind-boggling.
That's a fair statement, though.
Jeez. Right. And I've never heard of this place. King Abdullah University of Science and Technology.
Yeah, okay. You can Google it. Your listeners can Google it. It's right there on the internet.
So, how's their football team? All right, sorry, I didn't. Okay, that's amazing, Steve. Really amazing to hear about this. So, now let's proceed. You are, as I say, a great pioneer. When did you first start with solar, by the way? Just to date this situation.
Well, it's an interesting story. I actually took most of the shop courses in high school, even though I was in the college class, because they were more interesting. And so coming out of high school, I actually had some marketable skills. I took 4 years of electronics. I took 4 years of engineering drawing, and that was back in the day when we actually made drawings with pencils. And then coming out of engineering school, because I went to a school with a co-op, and they required us to work in our major. So graduating, I had a skill set coming right out the door, and I landed a to-die-for job on the Alaskan Pipeline Project.
Oh, my God. And what year was that?
That was in 73.
So you graduated high school in 1973,
This is college.
Oh, you went to college. Where'd you go to college?
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry?
Where'd you go?
Northeastern for engineering.
Oh, in Boston. Okay. So you graduated college in 1973, and you went straight to work on the Alaska pipeline.
Yes.
And you didn't run into Sarah Palin, I assume. So what did you do on the Alaska pipeline?
You could see her from see her place from where, you know.
Yeah. So what did you do on the pipeline? What was your job?
Well, what I was responsible with as part of a team, of course, for the energy systems to power the 52 remote gate valve stations along the pipeline, which are giant two-story high faucet valves that can be triggered to close in the event of a serious incident, such as an earthquake that would rupture the pipeline, or sabotage, or an act of war, or just some malfunction, because this goes up and down very tall mountains, and if it ruptured at the bottom of the valley, you got a hell of a lot of oil that's going to spill out and make one big mess. And so they had to section it off so that they would have only a portion of it. And so the 830-some-odd mile pipeline has 52 gate valves at strategic points that can section off and isolate. And those did not have crude oil crackers. The bigger pump stations that forces the oil through the pipeline have crude oil crackers to power them, but the gate valve stations had to have their own power source.
So did you come up with solar? Are they using solar on these places?
No, it's dark for 6 or 7 months of the year.
Oh, yeah,
so
yeah.
They can't use solar. But we use the same technologies that we're using today, the conversion and battery storage and other things. But the technology that was used is not really the core of the story. The story was during my tenure on the pipeline, there was a minor dust-up that you might remember in the Middle East, which within hours precipitated the first world oil embargo, and within hours after that, we had gasoline lines around every major city in the West anyway. And the price of oil went from $3.50 a barrel, $3.50 a barrel to
$3.50.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
$3.50 a barrel to $12.50 a barrel overnight, and it stayed there. Now, keep in mind that the boys that put their money into the pipeline were happy with the return on investment at the then $3.50 a barrel market price, and it went to $12.50 overnight and stayed there, so they were in hog heaven. And they threw money at us, literally threw money at us, to get this thing done as fast as we possibly could. And it was a wild ride for a young engineer. But they got to be a little too anxious, and they started falsifying the inspection records. Most importantly was the welding. The welding has to be done very carefully from inside the pipeline sections and outside the pipeline sections, and it has to be Magnaflux and X-rayed each time. And, of course, that's a lot of work. You've got to send an X-ray machine inside the pipe. It's got to know exactly where to go, and it's got to take an X-ray going out, going in, and then it goes on record, and there's inspections and all the rest. And they were so anxious to get this done, they thought, gee, you know, that's just a nuisance. That slows us down. So they started copying the old X-rays, turning them upside down or turning them upside right so that they'd look like different images, and they just put them in the file and told everybody to look the other way. And I thought
they do that at nuclear plants too. I don't know if people remember the movie Silkwood, but Karen Silkwood caught them at Kerr McGee falsifying X-rays as well.
Yeah, it's certainly something that's tempting. when you got a lot of money at stake and you don't really care about safety or longevity. So around that same time, remember now, the coincidental, just by serendipity, I guess, that very same first week in October that the oil embargo occurred because of the Middle Eastern war, the scientists and engineers and researchers who had pioneered photovoltaics for space-based power systems had many months before planned the first world colloquium on the life-affirming technology being used in terrestrial applications. And this was to be held at Bell Labs and hosted by Bell Labs in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And it occurred right in the middle of the oil embargo. And so what would have been an obscure scientific geek fest got international recognition because here's the world oil embargo. It's got us in gasoline lines and we're all held up and we're realizing, my goodness, how terribly dependent we are on petroleum. And here's a group of scientists and engineers looking into the future and figuring out how to use solar electricity on Earth. So my wife hates this and still rolls her eyes when I say that I fell in love with the technology.
Which came first, your wife or the technology? Oh, we won't ask that. So go ahead.
Well,
you don't have to answer that question.
My wife and I were baptized together as infants.
Okay.
And so she came first. But that's a whole nother story.
So you went to this, you left Alaska and went to New Jersey for this technology seminar in 1975?
I basically, in the spring of 74, after I'd saved up a little bit of money, they paid us very handsomely. And if you could work 200 hours a week, they'd gladly pay you for that. And came back to Boston with a little bit of money and a lot of enthusiasm and not knowing any better, started Solar Design to basically leverage my budding engineering skill set for sustainable purposes rather than going to the end of the earth to extract the last drop of fossil fuel, because even then you could see that, you know, this was quite a Herculean task, very disruptive to the environment, huge amounts of money. And obviously, you know, we know about the Exxon Valdez. There are lesser publicized issues with the pipeline. And, of course, now we have tar sands and we have more pipelines and we have fracking and we have deep water drilling and all of this. And it's basically, it's almost like a drug addict in the last throes of desperation. You know, it's before you burn the furniture to stay warm.
Right. We actually did that when I moved to a communal farm in further west of you in Massachusetts our first winter. We did burn furniture to stay warm, but we learned our lesson. I'm sure you know that the Alaska pipeline was voted on in the U.S. Senate, and it was a tie vote. The deciding vote in favor of the pipeline
was the vice president,
by Spiro Agnew, who was later thankfully removed from the presidency. We're talking with Steve Strong of Solar Design. We are not going to break. We're going to go straight through. Steve, you founded Solar Design in 1975, so you're going 74. On 40 years now. What were your first projects?
Well, it was a hard way to make an easy living, Harvey. It was photovoltaics were still in the province of space-based power systems. You couldn't buy any, but it was extremely enticing, so we started with passive solar and active solar thermal for space heating and domestic water heating and super insulated buildings and, you know, proper orientation and daylighting and internal thermal mass and very tight envelopes and the rest, building what the Germans now call a passive house and what we call then a passive-aggressive house. And that's
yes, and in that mode, I want to inform our readers, listeners, those of you who don't know, you heard it here first. When you build a house in the Northern Hemisphere and it's cold outside, you want the windows on the south side. Now, the American architectural profession has had a hard time figuring this out.
But Steve, I think you knew this in the beginning with solar design, right?
Well, of course. And the passive aggressive, the passive is to get the solar gain into the space and have a good enough envelope so that it stays there. The equivalent of a nice winter parka as an insulating cover as opposed to running shorts and a T-shirt in January. The glazing is most important, of course, because that's the highest level of conductive loss and radiated loss. So we built the foundation, the passive house, and then the aggressive part was energy efficiency. The energy, people are really surprised when I tell them, yes, I'm a solar engineer, but solar's the last thing I want you to do. But I say that so I can get their attention, and it is true. It is the last thing I want them to do, because there are so many things that are more important and more cost-effective, easier to do, and that's on the efficiency side of balancing the equation. You've got, obviously, the idea of having a winter parka instead of running shorts and a T-shirt in the winter. Well, that's the way we've been building our buildings. It's running shorts with holes in them and a T-shirt that's threadbare because we didn't care what the cost of energy was. It was so little in terms of our, you know, when we were building these houses in the 70s and 80s, even the energy was just not as important a part of the financial equation. So we wanted bigger, we wanted more space, and therefore we got less quality, we got more quantity. And now, of course, as you're probably aware, the trends are now to smaller houses of higher quality that will provide better, more comfortable living environments with less maintenance and more resiliency. And there's even a tiny house craze that's taking hold with the rising generation that's saddled with college debt and doesn't have the career opportunities climbing the ladder that our generation did. And so there's a lot of focus on tiny houses. It might even be a subject for one of your programs because it's quite a phenomenon.
It is, although I must say that, I lived communally for 14 years. I was young. I don't know if I could do it again. There's not much discussion about communal living as opposed to tiny houses. You know, why does everybody need their own kitchen facilities and all that stuff if everybody could live and share? And we'll see about that. I suspect a lot of old age homes and hostels and things like hospice things like that will start to be more communal. But Steve, you proceeded then, Steve Strong from Solar Design, into the solar business. And what happened now to change the focus as you moved ahead from the 70s?
Well,
in particular, you and I, we want to talk about the democratization of solar. So let's start to work that into our discussion if we can.
Well, we did our first, we did a lot of solar thermal. Solar thermal was and is very cost effective in the right applications. And so we started out with passive solar mainly at the residential scale, and then solar thermal, the residential and commercial scale. And that took us into the 70s. We did our first photovoltaic application in 1979.
Where was that?
In the Boston area. It was a very small 5-kilowatt solar electric array to power the pumps and controls for a 7,000-square-foot flat plate solar thermal system, which was providing domestic hot water to 296, if I remember correctly, dwelling units in a moderate income housing development. And the developers were young and future-oriented, and we were able to get them some incentive funding to make the solar thermal look a little more attractive. And they had plans to own and operate this facility, so it fit. And then what did we do after that? Our big break was to be commissioned by a utility company, believe it or not, Boston Edison at the time was the prevailing utility in the Boston area in eastern Massachusetts. And they were having trouble. This fits right into the other portion of your perspective. They were having a lot of trouble with the Pilgrim nuclear plant, safety issues and procedural violations, and they were getting a lot of bad press. And so somehow somebody higher up in the organization thought, solar energy is an interesting thing. Maybe we should build a demonstration solar house. And we were commissioned by the utility to design, engineer, and help get constructed a house of the future that was basically supposed to be how you will live 20 years into the future. What will housing look like 20 to 30 years into the future? And it had roof-integrated photovoltaics, roof-integrated solar thermal. It was earth-sheltered. It derived its heating and cooling from ground-coupled heat pumps. There was no fossil fuel on site. It was super-insulated, monolithic air and moisture barriers, sun-controlling geometry, the highest-performing glazing that we could get, which was, at that time, R11. This was in the early 80s.
How high has it gone now?
You can get R16, but it's not practical for residential windows because the perimeter is the fault line. There are thermal bridges in the perimeter, the frame, whatever frame you use. The highest performing one is a pultruded fiberglass with foam insulation inside. But if you put your hand on the frame, it's colder than the glass because there's materials that bridge, whereas the glass has an airspace. So at the perimeter of the glass, you've got a perimeter frame that basically holds the glass and any heat mirror film or other materials suspended. So you've got two pieces of glass and either a third piece of glass or a piece of film or even two pieces of film. But that's typically a metal frame element, and that's a thermal short circuit. So the highest R values for glass are center of glass R value, and it's in commercial glazing where you've got a much larger amount of center area as opposed to smaller windows have a limit, if you follow what I'm saying, because of the smaller perimeter. But what's most important is air sealing in a house. The average American house loses half of its heating energy through air migration, air infiltration, which people normally refer to as drafts. You go into an older house and you can see the windows. When there's a wind outside, the curtains are moving around on the inside because there's so much air leakage in the old windows. After all, they had to be loose enough so a child could open them. And when the trucks go by, they rattle. So you get an idea of how leaky the buildings are. Today's windows are very, very tight. The hardware has been advanced. The weather stripping is multi-layer and very pliable, so it lasts a long time and stays flexible. And all of these things add up to a building that uses between a half to a third, easily a half to a third of a typical building, whether it's a house or a commercial building. The piece I sent you on the commercial office building that we recently completed in Seattle, Washington, of all places, that is energy positive. That is, it makes more energy than it needs on an annual basis. And that's in Seattle, which is definitely suffering a photon deficiency.
That's a nice way to put it.
The summer is wonderful. It's blue sky from mid-May to late September, and then the fog comes in and the clouds come in, and it's kind of dreary for the rest of the year. So it was a challenge to do a commercial office building in downtown Seattle. But the New York Times and the folks at World Architecture have called this the greenest building on the planet.
And you designed it?
I did not design the building. I was part of a design team with mechanical, electrical engineers, civil engineers, structural engineers, a group of architects, and the International Living Futures Institute, which is headquartered in Washington State, that created what you may know of is the Living Building Challenge. And this is a very, very rigorous rating system where not only does the building have to make all of its own electricity from the renewable resources that are on site, it has to gather all of the water that it needs from capture on site. It's not allowed to connect to the city water supply or the city waste system, so it has to process all of its own wastes on site. There are 350 or 400 red-listed materials that you cannot have in the building or in the building materials that construct the building because they are at risk to health, dangerous to health, and it goes on and on. It's an order of magnitude more challenging than the U.S. Green Building Council's LEED rating system, and there are only probably a dozen or two dozen maybe buildings that qualify for the Living Building Standard worldwide at this point. And this was the first commercial office building, and it was in a challenging climate. So it's quite an accomplishment for the design team.
Wow, makes more that's amazing. So let's talk now with the spread of with your ability to build buildings like this, and I assume the technology has spread to commercial buildings, to, of course, to homes, manufacturing facilities. You talk about the great democratization of solar, and you emphasize that solar energy has a bright future and always will have. That's nonsense that the solar energy is with us today. So how are we in the process now of solarizing and democratizing our energy economy so we don't need fossil fuels or nuclear power?
Well, every day I'm working on those solutions. And quite honestly, Harvey, most of the major challenges are in the policy area or the political arena, not on the technology side. The technology is available. It's off the shelf. It's proven and reliable. It's reduced to practice. We know how to do this stuff. And if you're an honest accountant about where all the dollars are going in the energy world, you'll find that every source and system that's conventional or incumbent has got hundreds of millions or billions of dollars a year in incentives. And so in order to get to accelerate the transition to renewables, we need a level playing field. We've gotten some incentives and some policy decisions that are favorable. The utilities are, of course, not excited about that because most of them are looking at the future through a rearview mirror and just desperately now figuring out that they've got to struggle to maintain their incumbency and their publicly granted monopoly. But as far as the democratization is concerned, we've tried to take efforts in the best way we can with our leveraging our skill set. And we just recently completed the first shareholder-owned community solar garden here in Massachusetts, which is right across the street from our offices. Now, you probably, if you thought about it, you'd realize that the majority of people that have a utility account can't go solar, even if they wanted to. They live in a pine forest, or they're on the north side of a mountain, or their roof is contorted out of all dimensions with dormers and chimneys and turrets, or they live in a condo and they don't have access to roof, or they rent. Or if it's a commercial building, it's got air conditioning units all over the roof and there's no opportunity for solar harvest. And if you take all of those factors, you'll find that 60 to 70% of the people that have a utility account can't go solar even if they wanted to. And so the idea of community solar garden is a central array on a piece of land that's not prime. Brownfields are perfect. Landfills are perfect. An industrial site that has fallen into decay. It's a perfect opportunity to to reclaim lands that otherwise would be passed over and perhaps even deliberately avoided.
So you would put solar panels, a solar farm on this land?
Yes, a large solar farm. It's less expensive to build because of the volume and economies of scale. And in our model, which is unique, we wanted to see an equity position established where the shareholders were actually owners and had an equity position. So they could subscribe to the size of the solar system that was necessary to meet their needs. If they wanted to meet all their needs, it's very easy. You've got a year or two or three of electrical bills, and it's pretty easy to back out how much capacity you need, and they just sign up. They don't have to worry about any construction on their roof. They don't have to worry about cutting the pine trees down on the neighbor's land next door, or the chimney that's in the middle of the roof, or the dormers, or, you know, whatever, or even condo owners that don't have access to any roof aperture, or renters. It opens the market to the other 75% of the citizenry, either in residential or business, that for whatever reason.
You're saying that the communities can get together, build these solar facilities, and invest and share in the solar electricity, and thereby avoid paying the utilities for their coal, oil, nukes, and gas.
Absolutely. We set it up. It runs like a co-op, but it's set up as an LLC, and that's just because of the tax treatment. It's run as it's almost like a CSA, if you will. Instead of a community vegetable garden, it's a community solar garden.
And this model, have you successfully put it into play?
Yes, it's operational. It was sold out very quickly. It took us 2.5 years to get it approved and 2.5 months to build it.
2.5 approved by who?
Well, you wouldn't believe it.
I think I would.
Everybody in the world had to weigh in on this. We were subject to zoning variances because there was no specific zoning ordinance that allowed solar. You got wackos that come out of the woodwork on these public meetings and insist that the solar panels are going to leach toxic materials into the groundwater and poison everyone's water supply in town. And this fellow came out and insisted that the solar system was going to cast this electromagnetic field over the community, and everybody's reception and electronic reception would be messed up, and pacemakers would fail. And basically, these are just wacko excuses for what they really want to say is, hey, I don't want to look at this stuff. I know I've got nuclear. I know I've got coal. I know we've got tar sands and fracking, but I don't have to look at that. This solar stuff is silent. It's clean. It's non-polluting. It doesn't need any delivery of fuel. It doesn't need any emergency preparedness, but I have to look at it, and I don't want to look at it. And so that's what we had for 2 years.
God, and there's ulterior motives. I have friends in Falmouth. You probably know Chris Raleigh and Ron Zweig, and they've been fighting for the windmills and It's mind-boggling.
That's a real brouhaha.
So, here's the big question, Steve Strong, or solar design. Germany is now transitioning to renewable energy and phasing out rapidly not only their nuclear plants, which will be shut by 2022, but their coal, gas, and oil. You live in Massachusetts. I'm about to go to California. How do we, can we, and then how do we transition states within the United States to solartopia, to 100% renewables?
Well, let me tell you about California. You're going to love this.
Okay.
You're going to probably the most progressive place in the U.S. And interestingly enough, when Jerry Brown was governor very first time, at that point, he instituted a lot of progressive policy, which was a very aggressive energy efficiency program. And believe it or not, since then, California's electricity consumption has essentially been flat, even though they've had years and years of economic growth and population increase. And that statistics are not something that's cribbed off. This is the California Energy Commission proudly showing these consumption numbers. And so California has a very, very progressive policy. Governor Brown is back in office, and he's calling for very aggressive renewables goals. And the utilities realize which way the wind is blowing, literally. And Apple just spent $500 million to sign up for solar. Google is powering their facilities with solar. Solar's happening all over California. So
well,
I'm jealous.
The question
that you're
is,
gonna...
we need to shut the Diablo Canyon nuclear plants.
We're working on that.
Steve Strong, if you had an unlimited budget and all the permits you needed, how long would it take you and your technological cronies to convert California to a totally renewable energy economy?
The beautiful part, one of the many beautiful aspects of renewable energy, Harvey, is that it is more like a spontaneous technical diffusion rather than this decades-long process of plodding along to construct a central station power plant. We have more solar fielded in the last 12 months than we have nuclear power in the last decade, or probably two decades. Wind is the fastest growing source of new electricity on the planet. And it's because you've got hundreds of thousands of projects all going on simultaneously. The technology, again, is here. It's reduced to practice, proven and reliable, essentially off the shelf. All we need is the policy context. You've mentioned Germany. Well, also you've got Denmark, you've got Switzerland, you've got Spain and Italy and Belgium, and even France has forsaken nuclear and put solar on the top level of the agenda. And after Fukushima, Japan is struggling with not turning on any of their nuclear stations. We'll see if they're able to do that. But the solar program has been quadrupled. You can't get solar modules in the Japanese market now.
Wow.
And so the process is underway. The problem is that people are still desperately clinging to the past and looking at the future through the rearview mirror lens and saying, how do I protect what I'm used to doing? So the nuclear people obviously want to keep doing nuclear. This is fully predictable. It's like you remember Polaroid, and then Kodachrome came along, and Paul Simon sang about Kodachrome and how wonderful it was, and Polaroid lost a lot of market share. And then the digital revolution came along, and Kodak basically went bankrupt because they couldn't see what was happening. And now the current generation doesn't have a landline. They all have cell phones. What happened to AT&T? They couldn't see this. They were struggling. They were all struggling to hold on to what they knew how to do. And they didn't understand that the world is changing under their feet. And that's exactly what's
and
happening
now. The same thing happened in the music business, interestingly enough, where the record companies couldn't, basically dismissed. Go ahead, Steve.
Yes. iTunes.
iTunes. Yeah, they couldn't figure out iTunes, which Steve Jobs basically invented. So there you go. Steve Strong of Solar Design, we have about 5 minutes left. How can we make this transition politically and economically? I assume that California, for example, it would just take a few years at most to convert if we had all the material and all the permits and all the capital. Am I right?
More than a few years. It's probably a full decade, and that's with everything pulling all in the right direction.
Uh-huh.
I had the privilege to be on the roof with President Carter when he first dedicated the initial solar system at the White House. And at that time, he warned us in a visionary manner that no one could fully appreciate that there was a serious energy issue out there over the horizon, that average people couldn't discern it because it wasn't here. It was looming out there, but it was going to be the moral equivalent of war when America had to confront it. And he said, if we can get started now, we'll be able to make a comfortable transition to a new energy future. And that was, he was looking at 2 to 3 decades. And that was without doing any emergency anything, but just basically, and of course the technology was nascent at the time. Now we need the kind of policy that you've referenced in Europe. Europe is way ahead of us. Denmark exports renewable energy from their country every day. There was a day last spring, 2014, where Germany was 100% powered by renewables, solar and wind, because a weather front went through and the storm had cleared, the sky was bright, and the winds were still strong, and they had full solar and full wind, and Germany was exporting renewables from their country. Spain regularly has 60 or 70% wind penetration when a weather front comes through. And so the Europeans are way ahead of us, and thank God, because when we have a legislator with 15 seconds of attention span and they need to get the message quickly, and the utilities are throwing all of this stuff about, oh, God, our grid is so complicated, and this renewable stuff, it's going to cause all kinds of havoc. The sun's going to fall out of the orbit, and the moon will stop shining, and all the lights are going to go out. We can't handle this. We don't know. We can't. It's all harmonics, waveform malfunction, and frequency stability, and voltage sags, and oh, we don't know what we're doing. We can't deal with it. And we say very simply, oh, well, the Europeans have figured it out. I think you guys have got a lot of smart people in your engineering group there. I think you could probably get to the thing.
Steve, you know what? We are almost out of time. So if I can invite you back, you don't have to answer me right now. You can email me. I'd like to have you back next week for a half hour. And I want to very systematically go through the logistics of the transition to a green powered Earth. Think about that. You can answer me. We lay down a show that can be used and reused for about a half hour. If you can do that for me next, that'd be March 31st at 5:00 Eastern time. I'd love to have you back. Okay?
So all right. Thanks for the opportunity, Harvey.
Yes. Let me know if you can do that. In the meantime, this has been the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. We've been with the truly amazing and great pioneer in the solar world, Steve Strong. Solar Design is his company. Steve, what's your website? Oh, Steve went away. So look up Solar Design, Google it, Steve Strong. Hopefully he'll come back. And thank you so much, Crew in New York. Another great show. We'll see you on the radio next week with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show.
Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.